Hello, I'm Chloe McCulloch, Buildings Editor, and I'm here with...
Me, Elizabeth Hopkirk. I'm Assistant Editor on Buildings' sister title, Building Design.
Welcome to the Building Talks Net Zero podcast, a series looking at how the built environment can help us hit the UK's net zero carbon targets. Construction can help save the planet. It already has the knowledge and much of the technology that can set us on the path to net zero. Building Talks Net Zero focuses on the people with the positive ideas and technical know-how that can help the built environment reach its carbon goals. So Elizabeth, what's coming up on this episode?
Well, Chloe, we'll be joined as ever by our net zero jargon buster, Simon Wyatt, a partner at Cundall. He'll be explaining what we mean when we talk about design for performance in the context of buildings and a specific energy rating system that's increasingly being used in the commercial sector. And we have a chat with Tom Bennett, an architect at Studio Bark. He specialises in environmental design, but you might remember him from the headlines a couple of years ago when he was arrested during the Extinction Rebellion protests back in 2019.
And we'll be finding out why he became an eco-activist and why he believes more professionals in construction and architecture need to make their voices heard at a political level. Plus, we'll be going over some of the net zero headlines from the week as COP26 continues. That's all coming up on the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. Hello, listeners. We are back at Cundall's offices just opposite St Paul's Cathedral. It's lovely to be back. Thank you very much to Cundall.
Yes, and it was great to see them pick up Engineering Consultant of the Year at the Building Awards this week.
That was lovely. Yes, I saw some of the team there. I was at the Building Awards. It was a really great event, actually. For people who don't know, we couldn't hold the awards last year because of obviously the pandemic. So we skipped a year and, well, we did run awards online, but it was just so lovely to be back at the Grosvenor House Hotel. And
with 1,000 people in the room?
Well, yeah, just under 1,000 people, which was really amazing. Slightly scary because I was giving a speech in front of them, and not having done public speaking in front of that many people for a while was a little bit intimidating, but it all went very well. And so congratulations to Cundall and to all of the winners, actually. It was a really great event. So let's get into the episode, and we'll start with a bit of net zero news. I think the overwhelming topic has to be COP26. We have had the first week of COP. Obviously, a lot has happened. It started off with the world leaders first being there, and then I think they swiftly got moved away in the real policy negotiation. Yeah, their jets, which wasn't very net zero friendly. But then the negotiating actually happened, and I think we've seen for the first week we had some themed days. So I think we've had a finance day, which was pretty key, and the Chancellor Rishi Sunak unveiled some proposed new treasury rules for the UK, under which listed firms and some financial institutions will have to publish their net zero transition plans by 2023. Sounds great, but actually I think underlying that there were some concerns that these commitments aren't actually mandatory. So critics are saying, well, you know, these pledges are kind of doomed to failure if you don't actually give it some teeth. And I think we come back to this theme again and again, don't we, Elizabeth, when we're talking about net zero?
It's Greta's blah, 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 isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I do still think a lot of people did say that it was a massive step forward. And coinciding with that day, I think Mark Carney was also unveiling that a coalition of financial groups came together, and a mind-boggling amount of money, I think it's $130 trillion worth of private capital, is now so-called committed to transforming the economy to net zero. So that can't be a bad thing.
No, that sounds good, doesn't
it? And I think there is a realisation that the private finance has to do a lot of the heavy lifting. I think probably where the debate is around, there's a certain sort of ideological debate going on about how much do you leave it to market forces, how much do you try to say to governments that this is such, we've got to do this in such a hurry that you have to usher this in with legislation and regulation. And I think that's the tension there that we're seeing. And interestingly, I just want to plug our previous episode and Simon Wyatt's last Jargon Buster, where he was talking about the financial sector. And they did actually make a mention of the Task Force on Climate-Related Financial Disclosure as that being one of the guiding principles behind these new Treasury proposals. And
so if people want to know what that is, listen to episode 2.
Yes, exactly, because it did sound just like a huge piece of jargon, didn't it? But it actually does matter. Other stuff from COP, obviously, there's been the Energy Day. And
another big one.
I think over 40 countries have pledged to cut back on coal, but not the really big coal users, so it's not enough yet. But COP isn't everything. It's not it's a moment, and it should move things forward. But the work continues after everyone's left Glasgow. So, let's get to this week's keynote interview. Elizabeth, tell us a little bit about Tom Bennett, our guest this week.
Yes, well, hello, Tom. You're in the studio with us. Thanks very much for coming in. Tom works for Studio Bark, which is a young practice with a strong environmental focus and a lot of really beautiful private houses in rural locations under its belt. Before that, you worked with Wolfgang Buttress, and you designed the Hive that was the UK Expo Pavilion, but is now at Kew Gardens and beloved by many, allowing people to commune with the bees. But in 2019, you made headlines for a very different reason. You were arrested during the, I think, second wave of Extinction Rebellion protests. Tell us, how did that come about?
Sure. Well, firstly, good to be here. And I suppose in terms of the XR protests in 2019, I'd previously been involved in environmental activism at university, and like a lot of people, I suppose, I've been concerned about climate change for a long time. So, when XR came on the scene, I sort of felt like I needed to investigate and go along to it and see what it was all about. Myself and my colleague Nick, we just decided that we'd go down for the start of the April 2019 protests. So we just went along to Oxford Circus, no kind of expectations or idea what would happen. So I guess there were probably a lot of people like myself wallowing in sort of private despair. And I think what XR did was tap into that and actually provide a way for all those people to kind of come together in some sort of public expression of the need to engage the issue. It was definitely exciting, but the whole energy of the city, I think, was certainly from my perspective quite different in those 2 weeks.
And then you were arrested. Tell us what happened.
Part of the tactic used by XR was a form of civil disobedience. So this is the idea that you kind of deliberately defy the state or break some sort of rule to highlight an injustice or the injustice of the situation. So initially I had no intention of putting myself in that kind of situation. I saw the kind of need for it, because ultimately if no one was willing to sort of defy the police, then the police turn up and say, right, you lot, leave. And everyone leaves and the protest is over. The media coverage ends. So I saw that as being a kind of integral part of the success which I felt XR was having in terms of media cut through and that kind of thing. And ultimately I just had a strong feeling that I should be willing to do that myself. If I was happy that other people were doing this, then why would I sort of hold back from doing that myself if I thought that was kind of the right thing to do?
So where were you when you and what were you doing when you were arrested?
Yes, I was on Waterloo Bridge, and I was actually...
Is that where they cut Waterloo Bridge off, didn't they? So there was no traffic able to go over, is that?
There were no vehicles going over the bridge. There were still a lot of pedestrians and cyclists and that kind of thing. But I'd kind of gone there because I'd been at Oxford Circus for the whole rest of the time. So this was actually the Easter weekend. So it's right in the middle of the 2 weeks. So I went to that, and shortly after it became clear the police were going to try and clear the bridge. And so, yeah, I suppose those of us that felt we wanted to delay that process and allow the protest to continue to happen sort of sat down in the bridge on the road. And we're eventually arrested.
And what's it like to be arrested?
I suppose it's quite surreal for, you know, someone like me, or like probably for a lot of the people listening to the show, it'd be quite a surreal thing. I think we're kind of socially conditioned, aren't we? So we're trained to be quite obedient and, you know, respect the law and all that kind of thing, which, you know, is important up to a point. I suppose from my perspective, I'd done some preparation, I'd done some training, I'd spoken to people that have been through that experience. So, you know, I had a sense of what to expect from it. And what actually happened was roughly in line with that. But yeah, I think the first time you're arrested, like when the officer sort of says to you, right, you're now under arrest, there's something slightly surreal about that, I suppose.
Did you have a moment of thinking, gosh, what have I done? Or
not really at that point. I mean, I'd already decided that I was willing to take that step. I'd thought about it long and hard as I was.
Right, so where did it lead to? Did it lead to any prosecution?
XR had done something previously. They'd done an action on the bridges in 2018. And after that, there were no prosecutions. Actually, the Crown Prosecution guidance on this, the guidance on public order law, says, prosecutions are really there to penalise violence. It's an interesting decision that the CPS have made. Personally, I think the wrong one. But, they decided to prosecute everyone, or try to prosecute everyone who was arrested in 2019. Including myself. So I had my day in court.
And you were found guilty?
I was, yes.
And then so then you do have that on your record. And in fact, then the ARB, the Architecture Registration Board, came calling. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, I mean, in truth, I actually went to them because I was kind of aware that in the code, if...
The Architect's Code.
The Architect's Code, that's right, yeah. If you've done something that could potentially bring the profession into disrepute, you're supposed to tell them. So I thought I should tell them, and so I kind of wrote to them to say what had happened, and they said, that's fine. When you get your prosecution letter, bring it. So actually, with the Architects Climate Action Network, we had a little gathering outside the ARB at the time when I handed over my kind of criminal conviction to the ARB. And that was actually a good opportunity to, we kind of went in and sat down with them and had a discussion about, you know, how the ARB is responding to the climate crisis as well.
And personally for you, that having that prosecution and conviction, do you feel like it is going to affect your professional career, or are you fine with it? Is it going to be something that you can kind of be relatively proud of?
I'm fine with it, to be honest. And it, you know, it's interesting that I think in a way that whole sort of episode has opened other doors. So, you know, I'm here and I've been invited to talk about that and to speak about that experience. So yeah, I don't have any regrets about that at all. No.
And the ARB, after that conversation, were happy for you to stay on the Register of Architects, clearly.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. After that, the ARB published some guidance around, you know, convictions and protest. And, you know, I think they took the view that it didn't really have any bearing at all on my ability to sort of practice as an architect or anything like that. So, it was good to get some clarity from the ARB around that.
And I know you wrote for our websites a couple of weeks back, making quite a strong argument that we can get sucked into the detail maybe of pitching a great project or looking at a very detailed area of policy, but actually you might have more impact if you get politically involved. Is that, could you explain that argument a little bit to our listeners?
Sure. I think where that comes from is, you know, thinking quite hard about why we haven't solved this yet. Like, we've known about it for so long, and, you know, sometimes that's pitched as, well, we don't have the right mix of solutions yet. And I don't quite buy that either, because, like, you know, people have been pitching solutions for a long time. I don't know if you've read Heat by George Monbiot. That was a very sort of comprehensive vision for how the economy and society could get to net zero by 2030, written in the 2000s. So I think, you know, the detail is obviously important and thinking about that stuff, but what's missing, you know, in my kind of analysis, I suppose, is the impetus or like the political will for that stuff to happen. So we have what I'd call an implementation gap. And I think the way to close that is to bring that pressure to bear on the political system.
And I suppose that brings us to something very topical at the moment, which is COP26 and that climate conference, where you've got, well, you had world leaders at the start, now you've got the sort of policymakers sitting down doing deals alongside. There are plenty of activists up in Glasgow trying to put pressure on, trying to make the case. What's your view of what's going on in Glasgow at the moment?
Yeah, I think it's hugely important that movements are sort of on the streets in Glasgow and making their voices heard. And yeah, I think we had a report that all of the kind of voluntary contributions of countries are going to add up to, I think, 1.9 degrees of warming. And that's if those kind of pledges are actually met, which is a pretty big if. So there's a lot of work to be done. You know, ultimately, I mean, COP is a moment, but these negotiations are ongoing. You know, diplomats are talking about this stuff all the time. So it's, yeah, it's, you know, COP is not the be-all and end-all, and we're not going to come out the other side of COP26 with everything fully resolved. So it is important that, yeah, movements and activists are kind of doing that work to hold government to account.
Tom, thanks so much. That's really fascinating. If people are inspired by what they've heard, what's your advice? How should people sort of put their toes in the water?
Yeah, I think it's really key that people approach this from a collective perspective, and, you know, so that might involve finding a group of like-minded people and connecting up with them. That could be a group in the profession or a movement outside of the profession. So, yeah, I would sort of encourage everyone to find their feet in that broad spectrum of movements. And as well, I think just to think about how you're going to reflect on this moment looking back. So would you wish you'd done more or done things differently, and maybe making some space to sort of contemplate that, I think is important.
Do you ever feel like you've done enough? I mean, is it quite a burden sometimes taking all of this on?
I think for me, you know, hope is a conditional thing, and it comes from taking action. You know, before XR, although I'd been involved in activism before, I'd, you know, there was a gulf between knowing and doing. And there's this saying, right, that, you know, knowing and not doing is basically the same as not knowing. So I think, you know, you do resolve some of that sort of cognitive dissonance by getting involved in stuff and taking action. So, yeah, taking action gives me hope, and I think has a lot of benefits. So, yeah, I definitely encourage people to do that as well. But, you know, as to whether it's ever enough, I mean, I think you kind of have to recognise your limitations as a human as well. And doing something is definitely a good start. So
I was going to say, so obviously it can all sound quite heavy and serious. And so, like, how, what's your light relief? What do you do just to kind of switch off from, because work and your activism, it's very connected. It could be all consuming. How do you just, you know, switch off sometimes?
How do I switch off?
Or do you never? Do you never switch off?
I mean, I'm currently building a boat. That's a good diversion.
What kind of boat?
Yeah, it's like a houseboat. So I'm actually using our modular e-build system to construct it.
How's it going? So,
slowly, very slowly. Yeah, I think it is important to have a bit of R&R. So yeah, I think for me it's mainly just connecting with friends and family and personal projects.
And are you building it literally on your own, or is there a whole gang of you?
Yeah, I've had a lot of friends come and help, and I've dragged my girlfriend into it quite a lot and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, the plan is to live on it eventually.
Sounds a bit Noah's Ark. Is this, you know, when the tides rise, you're going to be safe?
Yeah, I haven't really thought about the symbolism, but I see where you're coming from.
So, Elizabeth, I think that interview was really interesting and worth reflecting on a little bit. I mean, my impressions, I don't know quite what I was expecting from an eco-activist. I think I was expecting someone very angry and passionate, and Tom comes across as very calm, very measured. You know, he thought through what it was going to be like and prepared to be arrested, and he weighed that up. He thought about it morally, and he in his mind was convinced that peaceful protest was worth being arrested for. I don't know what you felt.
Yes, yeah, I found it quite challenging actually. This idea that the only way we'll really, the only way to convince governments and perhaps the wider public that the things that really radical things need to change is to take radical action and civil disobedience is. I mean, it's a tried and tested measure, isn't it? But, you know, would I be prepared to be arrested? It's a very challenging question.
I think that's it. It forces you to reflect on what are you prepared to do? You're listening to the Building Talks Net Zero podcast. And now for Simon Wyatt and our regular Net Zero Jargon Buster session. This week, Simon is focusing on neighbours, and I don't think he means the Australian soap. Hi, Simon. It's great to have you back with us this week.
It's a pleasure to be back.
So the idea this week is that you're going to have 2 minutes uninterrupted to explain this topic, and then Elizabeth and I will jump back in with some follow-up questions, if that's okay.
Yep, that's fine. I'll try and be as concise as possible.
Fantastic. Okay, over to you.
So Neighbours UK is an energy rating scheme which has come over from Australia. And as you said, it's not based on the TV show, unfortunately. It was introduced over a decade ago and has reduced commercial office energy consumption by about 70%. It was brought over to the UK later last year by the Better Buildings Partnership and is now operated by the BRE. The system works by taking the landlord's energy consumption over a 12-month period, comparing it with benchmark targets and giving it a star rating from 1 to 6, with 6 being the best. The typical UK average stock at the moment isn't even really achieving a 1-star rating, so there's a significant amount of work that needs to be done. There is often confusion around Neighbours UK and something called Design for Performance. Design for Performance came out before Neighbours UK and is the operational energy assessment methodology for new buildings which are being designed, used to predict a Neighbours rating. So in short, Neighbours is for live buildings using real performance and is the one that really matters, whereas Design for Performance is predicting a Neighbours rating in design so designs can be marketed at a certain standard. In Australia, the best performing buildings that are being designed at the moment are generally achieving 5, 5.5 and even up to 6-star ratings. And that's after a decade worth of practice, fine-tuning and improving the system. In the UK, we have the first pioneering projects going through the process at the moment, and they're aspiring to very high levels, which might be a bit optimistic, kind of at 5, even 6 stars. We expect most of them will probably come in, hopefully around 4 stars in the first pioneers, but 6 stars is extremely challenging. And 6 stars is actually roughly equating to the LETI UKGBC Paris Proof target. So only when you're achieving 6 stars can you really claim to be net zero carbon Paris aligned. So there's still a long way to go for the market, seeing as there aren't any. There's lots of commercial office claiming to be net zero carbon, but none of them are hitting this 6-star standard. So one nuance of the UK Neighbours scheme is that it only covers the base building energy consumption associated with the landlord system, so lighting, ventilation, heating. It doesn't cover the tenant energy consumption associated with plug-in loads like computers, which is good for design teams because it enables them to focus on the things that they can influence. But we still need to be mindful of the whole building when we're talking about net zero carbon, and we want to meet the LETI or UKGBC Paris proof targets. So that it's a good scheme, but it needs consideration with other consumption.
Thanks for that explanation, Simon. I think we've got some very pressing questions for you now, Elizabeth.
Yes, if we're not even achieving a one-star rating, I mean, we're just decades behind Australia.
Well, that's the point. It's taken Australia 10 years to get to where they are. When they're basically at the same point, they started at the same point we're at now. So 10 years ago, a Melbourne office building was very similar to a London office building now. They're generally at around about 200 to 300 kilowatt hours per meter squared. And as we discussed a couple of weeks ago, the LETI UKGBC targets are down around about 70. So it's a significant reduction. And it's just come from fine-tuning designs and how buildings actually operate. Because at the end of the day, they're still designing them with the same equipment, same systems in the building. They're just designing the operation, commissioning and controls much better, and have had years of experience at trying to optimise this, whereas in the UK, it's not something we focused on.
Does it need to take us 10 years? Can we piggyback on the Australians?
To a degree, yes. And again, as I said, the pioneering projects we've got in the UK have jumped straight to 5 and 6 stars, which is the best that the Australians are managing now. So I expect we will catch up that gap very quickly. But I think there's a lot of optimism in the market at the moment. And when they actually get the metered data, because that's what matters, the actual performance in use, they're not going to achieve all they've set out to achieve. But if they can get close to that, it would be a great start.
We get press releases all the time saying such and such a company has been working on a net zero carbon project, or it's about to be unveiled, or it's going to be the first one of its kind. How can they make those claims when they're not necessarily part of the Neighbours Pioneer projects?
Again, it comes down to what we were discussing a couple of weeks ago, which is the net zero carbon definitions and the step trajectory we were talking about. So the UKGBC has 5 steps. It's got 2020, 2025, all the way through to 35. And ultimately, the 35 or the 2050 target is the Paris aligned, which is net zero carbon. But every 5 years, there's basically a ratcheting down. So the buildings which are achieving performances and claiming to be net zero carbon are hitting the interim targets. They're only going to be net zero carbon for a short period. For example, if you're achieving 5-star neighbours, that's an equivalent to the 2025 step from UKGBC.
This all seems quite depressing. We're a long way off, aren't we?
Looking at it as a trajectory. So we need, the targets are generally all new buildings to be net zero carbon by 2030. Obviously, it's been introduced over 2 years. There's lots of designs on the boards at the moment that are being reviewed. So they're all making step changes. And I think we've got to be realistic. Like a building, we can't jump straight to the net zero carbon. But if we can do it in 2 or 3 steps and continuously improve and learn those lessons, and this is the commercial office sector I'm generally talking about, which is what Neighbours is for, it's very problematic because you don't know who your end tenants are. So you're designing a building for a lot of worst case, a lot of assumptions. Where you're working with end users, so working with higher education facilities, we're doing much better because we're able to target what they're doing. There isn't a Neighbours rating, but there are similar net zero carbon standards. Another difficult one, which LETI's really focused on, is residential. Again, there's no Neighbours. You've got tenants, which are problematic in the in the nicest sense of the word. But again, it's a different approach for the different sectors. But the commercial office sector's got a really good approach. We thought it would be problematic, and they're really driving it forward, and the pioneering projects are really exciting. But let's not get carried away. We're not going to jump straight to a 6-star building.
So it sounds like Neighbours, what's going for it, the good thing about it is the rigour and the robustness and the credibility that you get by signing up for it. Is that really what you would say? Is it the most rigorous system out there in the market now?
Yes, but the main focus is its performance and use. So The design for performance and the commitment agreement are all well and good, but they're just an estimate. What's important is the 12 months actual data. So for the first time ever, we're going to be going, what is the actual performance of that building? We're going to be getting a star rating. That will be used to let the building, and it will drive the void periods and the value of that asset, really. So it's really changing from a design focus where we can go, okay, if everything works well, this is a great building, to actually we need to control, commission, manage the building effectively to deliver real performance in use.
So Simon, let's just end on one last question. Just going back to the reference that I made at the start about how we as journalists get bombarded with press releases on with various net zero claims. How do we check those credentials?
So what we've been doing at Cundall, and I've been working with quite a lot of clients at the moment, is making it very clear when we say net zero carbon what we actually mean. So the main thing is, what is the definition they're working to? So is it UKGBC framework? How is it calculated? So the embodied carbon is calculated in accordance with RICS. What modules is it looking at? A1 to A5, the upfront in carbon, or is it the whole life carbon? But for operational energy, the key is, what is the calculation methodology? So today we've obviously been talking about design for performance. So it's calculated in accordance with design for performance and being independently verified. Or equivalents are things like Passive House or SIBC TM65. And the key is where they are in the stage. So it's if it's a design, operation energy is net zero carbon enabled. It's not net zero carbon in operation, because operation means you've got 12 months worth of data and it's in operation. It's just net zero carbon enabled, which is basically saying we've done some calculations, it's been independently verified, and here is where we think we sit. But that's dependent on the operation.
Thank you so much, Simon. I think that's useful advice for everyone in the sector, not just journalists reporting on it. So thank you very much. We will come back to you next week for another jargon-busting session.
Thanks for having me.
So that's it for this week's Building Talks Net Zero podcast. We'll be back again next Monday with reflections on the final week of COP26. And with more guests lined up for you.
In the meantime, if you want to get in touch with the show with any questions or comments, please email us at newsdesk@building.co.uk or on Twitter @buildingnews.
And actually, also, we'd like to ask you a specific question this week. What are you doing to achieve net zero on your projects? We'd love to hear from you. And we'll be reading out responses in next week's podcast.
So please do subscribe and you'll get our latest episode delivered to you each Monday.
You've been listening to Chloe McCulloch and Elizabeth Hopkirk. Podcast producer is Tarek Aziz. Thanks for listening and goodbye.